Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
All right, This Life podcast. I want to introduce everybody to our sponsor, Rocky Mountain Treatment Center. You've heard me speak of them before. Bob and I have investigated these guys, and we are impressed that they are an abstinence-based, high-quality program. So we are pleased to have them on. They're located.
You know how I investigate things? Mm. I ask people in the region.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then
I
talk.
You can't go by what the place says.
No, well, you talk to the people, too. You get a sense of what they're. Listen.
Yeah.
Some are forthcoming about what they are doing that we don't dig.
But there's some good ones I've found around, and it's by talking to the people in the 12-step community, like, hey, what do you think of that place? And they'll give it a thumbs up, thumbs sideways, or thumbs down.
This is in Great Falls, Montana, 26-bed facility surrounded by beautiful landscape, equine therapies, all kinds of individual therapies that are available. Very, very well-trained professionals up there. Again, for more information, it's rocky.rehab, or click through the banner on the thislifepodcast.com or drdrew.com, or visit their website. Again, that rocky.rehab. Again, this is Playroom Pod Production. Thank you so much. Produced by Susan Pinsky. Also, thanks, shout-out to our amazing sound engineer, Nate the man. Potker man? Or was that supposed to be poker?
Nate the man. Potker.
Nate the man, Potker.
Okay. I named him Nate the man like 10 years ago. You know.
Got it. Also, be sure to give us the review at iTunes and comment. Support the show at drdrew.com/contact. You can send in emails. We'll try to address some of those. Again, the conditions under which we apply them, there's all sorts of legal and ethical issues that go into what we do, what I can do with emails, but I will get to the sort of meatier question and speak in generalities about the kinds of things you'd like answers for. And finally, be sure to check out the Amazon banner at drdrew.com. And
it's free.
Yeah, it's free. It doesn't cost you anything, but it supports Caleb Nation, who's our incredible web guy. And last but not least, go to the Dr. Drew podcast, Adam and Dr. Drew podcast on Corolla Digital. So today, Bob, want to introduce our guest?
Well, it's Michael, A.A. Michael.
Oh, great.
Michael Carano.
Fantastic.
We also have...
You're no longer a comedian.
I have other problems I can get credit for.
You've joined in with us. You're no longer a comedian.
But also, Patrick...
The future head of Comedy Cares, by the way.
Really?
When's that going? When's that going
to
start?
We talk about it at lunch.
You're gonna head that all... That could be a huge thing. Good
That's
for
the plan.
You.
It's being of service. It's my being of service.
Congratulations.
And we're here with a man who does lawyer care.
Yes. Patrick Krill works at the Hazleton Betty Ford Foundation Legal Professionals Program. And Bob, we used to treat a lot of lawyers and doctors, if you remember.
Yeah.
And is your mic on there? Let's check it. There.
It is.
Patrick,
yeah,
there
nice
you are.
To be with you.
Until
Pleasure
you got sued.
You.
No. And we
no,
used
the
to
other bar, the other bar is the organization we were associated with, and they used our facility all the time. And they're so lawyer-esque, they don't even allow you to know who's in it.
Right. Yep.
It was weird because we were like, do we report to somebody? They're like, no. Is there things documented about this?
Well, but that's in fact one of my concerns about how we got doctors. We brought it to the state. We held them hand to the fire. But attorneys don't seem to do that same kind of policing.
They don't. The medical profession does a much better job with creating accountability.
I would also argue nursing does better than doctors, too.
They do.
Yeah.
And we actually just published a study with the American Bar Association on the current rates of addiction, depression, anxiety in the legal profession. We asked about barriers to help seeking, and to Bob's point about not wanting anyone to know, that was the number one identified barrier to help seeking.
But they'll go to ridiculous lengths. Like they won't even talk to a doctor about it.
They won't.
Yeah.
There's a huge amount of just, obfuscating any sort of notion that we have a problem. It's just hide it.
I remember I don't know if you were around, we were treating judges
and
stuff.
Is it the most hidden? Here's the thing. So we had the Catholic Church contract. We had Catholic priests in our facility. We had the other bar. We had lawyers. We had doctors diversion and nurses diversion. So we were treating a lot of different professionals.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, even the Catholic priests were more open than the lawyers.
Yeah.
We need a new spotlight.
Right.
Spotlight/JD.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it's something about the profession, I think. And
well, they know the consequences.
Well, it's probably the same with politicians, right?
They all are politicians.
But, I mean, you're not going to come out and go like, I've got a problem, vote for me.
Well, when they do, it's worked out very well. Like Patrick Kennedy, and there was a
guy.
Well, he had to. He tried to vote on the Senate floor
with
his car.
But the thing with lawyers, and it really starts in law school, if you think about the oath that you take as a lawyer, right? You're saying that you're going to uphold yourself in a certain way and basically behave and live a certain way, and the ethical bar is set pretty high. And when you're in the midst of an addiction, you are just, you know, flat out sort of violating your oath of how you're supposed to be conducting yourself. So there's that piece of it.
Hey, let me ask you this. Is it just the using, or is it the usual behaviors that go on with using that they know they're going to have to look at also that they really are recoiling from?
Well, it's both. I mean, sometimes it's just the using, but that is, you know, that's sort of putting you in a mental state that you're not really capably discharging your duties, yeah, right, as a lawyer. So that's a big piece of it. And then the other thing that I see with my clients all the time, I work with lawyers, judges, and law students exclusively, is this fear of letting anyone know that they're not sort of perfect.
Right.
Right. Because people come to lawyers, they come to us wanting the answer. We're supposed to be the ones who are in, you know, in control and, you know, not struggling with something like an addiction.
Yeah. And so I've counseled a couple lawyers. One was disbarred and went to prison. And I always wanted him to speak out. He wrote a book. His life is better now than it ever could be because, yep, he was in real estate law. He just went into equity funds. He made more money than he's ever going to make as a lawyer. But what it was is he got sober over that case, and he stayed sober through prison. Mm. And is still sober to this day, 10, 12 years later. And he says it was freeing. Once they said you're no longer a lawyer, it was a shaming thing. And then he's like 33. He's got to figure out, what the fuck am I going to do with my life? I've lived my life up until now based around that license.
Right.
You know, and I think, you know, that's a big fear of in the other bar. That certainly was a fear. Like if you commit a criminal act, drug possession, you know, you don't get your license taken away if your possession of drugs, if you're a doctor. You do if you're a lawyer.
You could. Yeah.
You can't.
You could,
yeah,
because you're breaking the law.
You can't commit a felony, right?
Right.
And doctors can commit felonies.
They just can't do it twice.
Have you ever seen any ramifications from a lawyer, somebody maybe possibly suing a lawyer saying they didn't accurately defend me because they were drunk?
Sure. I knew a guy that blew a murder trial, came to treatment, and everybody it was like a shark eating frenzy.
Yeah, well, it happens a lot more than is ever reported, right? And that's one of the things that we're trying to advocate for some change around. The legal profession has got to do a better job of intervening on these attorneys who are out there really sort of practicing while impaired. And there tends to be this, default mindset of looking the other way, you know, among colleagues. So, I think that.
Why don't they create a wellness sort of system like we have for physicians? That changes everything.
I think that would help.
The way we do it is, it's a physician run, some administration,
peer driven,
peer driven committee that you get referred to readily and any outlying behavior. And our job, I've been in several of those committees. The job is to attend to the wellness of the physician so they don't end up in trouble.
Do they interfere?
And it's all confidential. You may let them not. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, when I'm walking through a casino in Vegas and there's signs everywhere, got a problem with Gamblers Anonymous, I can't imagine somebody's like, you know, yeah, I'm calling. I mean,
here. Well, so what do you mean?
Knowing
interfere?
There's help available doesn't mean you're going to go like, I might have a problem.
No, they have something happens at a hospital.
Right. You refer.
A patient complains.
You get referred for. No.
That's what I mean. If somebody come in and go, you might have an issue. Do you want to talk about this or do
you
that?
You get referred. The referral process is protean. In other words, you can get referred for raising your voice. You get an evaluation. We're all over everything. Anything that seems a little outlying, boom, refer. Because everyone knows it's for your own well-being. If somebody referred me, I go, let me talk to them. If I have something I need to attend to, fine. I know they'll give me high-quality care. I know they'll keep it confidential.
There'll be no shame
involved. No shame. They'll be looking out for me. It's for the wellness of the doctor.
Yeah.
Then if they f*** up, then it's about the hospital and the licensing and everybody else. Right. But in the meantime,
that just doesn't happen in the legal profession. You have attorneys working shoulder to shoulder with other attorneys who are completely impaired. And, you know, they don't say anything. It's just the only time it ever comes to a head.
F. Lee Bailey.
I was just going
to
say F. Lee Bailey.
During the
he was drunk all the time.
Marvin Mitchelson.
That's right. Who's the dude with the tassels?
But during the O.J. Simpson trial, he just looked like he was developing an alcohol
Jerry
dementia.
Jerry Spence. Right. Well, he's had DUIs. He's had several DUIs.
Who has?
F. Lee Bailey.
Oh, really?
He's gone. Yeah. He's died a long time ago, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Anyway, we keep interrupting.
So, it's just fascinating that because I believe in this. I believe musicians. I worked at a musician's drug program for years and years. Musicians can talk to musicians. Lawyers can talk to lawyers. Doctors can talk to doctors. Comedians can talk to comedians. Right. We're actually, it's kind of a joke, but we are forming that.
I go one step further. Veterans can talk to veterans. People who've been in combat, veterans particularly, can talk to combat veterans.
So we know this, and that's why we wanted to have, I wanted to have you say what's going on over there at Hazelden, Betty Ford.
And is it there? Is it, or are you just sort of representing them out in the world?
No, here? I run a program in Center City at Hazelden.
I'm a Center City alumnus three times.
Nice.
Well, does Betty Ford put her name to the Minnesota program?
Yeah, we're merged.
No, Hazelden.
I thought it was just out here. No. Oh, my God.
Hazelden took over Betty Ford.
I thought out here, but I didn't realize that they'd merged their names.
Yeah, it's everywhere. It's in West Hollywood.
One organization.
No, I thought just out here, Bob. I didn't realize that it was one national organization, which is fantastic.
So, but to Bob's point about, you know, people from one group being able to help people from that same group, that's part of the program I run. And it's, you know, it's a group for the lawyers, judges, and law students to get together and really talk about their stuff in a way that they can't when they're amongst people who, you know, they just feel too much shame admitting what they were doing as a practicing lawyer.
And you can't, they don't feel like people could relate to it. I probably couldn't relate to it. Not really. But when I hear my physician peers talk about it, I get what they're talking about. I get it.
Yeah. You wouldn't probably know by looking at me, but my best friends are lawyers, and one's a murder.
No, we would figure that you spent some time with lawyers. We would figure. By looking at you specifically.
You know, he has represented people he knows are guilty of murder.
Yeah.
That's law in America. Yeah. That's just how it is.
No, they have a different charge.
And so how you cope with that within your own psyche, that takes some medicine.
Yeah, well, we do see a lot of sort of vicarious trauma with people, especially criminal attorneys. But then, you know, what they come up with through the profession is just seeing heavy drinking so normalized. It's not like that in the medical profession, I don't think.
No.
You know, but just starting in law school, that's how you blow off steam. That's the default mechanism. Uh-huh. And, you know, it continues on into the profession. One of the things we uncovered in this study that we just published is that the rate of problem drinking among attorneys is between 21 and 36%.
It's a lot.
Which is pretty significant. And, you know, that also it goes along with the rates of depression, which are significant, and anxiety. So all told, the profession is kind of in a bad place.
Particular types of practice of law that are more represented in the
trouble group? There's nothing that's, you know, really, there's no group that's really far out there.
I think it's so insidious. I know it very well. There's a monthly event here of the, I won't say what type of lawyers, and the district attorney of the city comes to it quite frequently, and there's been jokes are, I hope you're not driving tonight in my presence. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, these guys live in their own world.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Their
well,
own
that is the
world.
Other thing I've noticed. Maybe this is now stepping away from addiction and mental health, but it seems like my friends are lawyers and things. It's like the law is like an abstraction. For us, for those of us citizens, it's like a concrete reality. And for you guys, it's just something that can be manipulated. Am I right?
Yeah. I think that's true. And then think about that, those skills of being able to manipulate the truth and facts and kind of craft arguments to, you know, for your side. Take those skills and put them on top of an addict, right? So, you know, somebody, an alcoholic, an addict, somebody who
you
already
got me with no law degree.
No. Well, just so hang on a second. Mike, imagine you with a law degree. That's what Mike just looked at me. Where do I get a law degree? I saw that look.
I'm going to go take the bar.
I can do it.
I think that's part of why lawyers can be such difficult patients, right? And I mean, they can be really difficult to sort of bring into recovery because they have a lawyer's skill set at their disposal to defend their addiction. And sometimes that's, you know, pretty tricky.
Yeah, a little obfuscating.
So how do you break down that? Wow.
It helps to have them be around other lawyers who can call them on their bullshit, right?
So they know when the lawyerism is coming out and it's serving the addiction.
Right.
Interesting.
I imagine once they get it pretty succinctly.
They can. And that's one of the things
but
that
I'd be getting them to get it. I don't see how. Yeah, a lot of murky.
Well, it's interesting. We did not treat a lot of lawyers in our day. And I think it's because we did not tolerate much.
We had the thing that Pat Martin had the other bar.
Yeah,
right?
No, we were very fond. I was very
there
ball
was
with
one
them.
I remember. It was a woman lawyer.
Yeah.
And she dressed up like she was going to court every morning. And after about 2 weeks, I was like, you know, you don't have to get dressed like a skirt and shoes. And
I remember
like,
we were in
a rehab center.
You know, wool.
Everyone else has got pajamas on.
Yeah.
It was so weird. And it was almost like her identity as a lawyer. Yeah. You know what I mean? That she was, so it kept everyone at a distance. Like everyone else is in pajama bottoms.
But we treated,
this woman's in a law.
We treated a few. Put your headset on, Bob. Your mic's 8 feet from
your
mouth.
I can hear it. I can hear it. Okay. Okay.
But listen. We treated a lot of female lawyers, but not many. We had a few judges, I remember. Oh my God, that was so frustrating. But the mostly female lawyers, and they were when they got it, they came around very.
Why
nicely.
Were judges frustrating?
They were retired. The two that I remember were retired, and they were just alcoholic.
Hardcore.
So deeply
and
alcoholic.
I'm frustrated with their physicians who wouldn't. Crash down.
Well, Pasadena is an old boys town.
It was all of that stuff.
You question their ability on the bench?
They were already retired.
No. I'm thinking of a couple that were demented. But it was interesting. I had a long conversation about these lawyers years ago, where the neuropsychologist was talking about overlearned material, and if when you have overlearned professional material that you can just go, if he was doing something perfunctory on the bench. We know it so well as professionals. It's just like you lose a lot of other stuff before you lose that.
Yeah,
that comes later. That's a really good point.
And so you could work but not be human. You could grocery shop.
Or it wasn't quite that bad, but you work, but you could forget about how much you tilted that morning.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
it's like Glenn Campbell.
That's a little worse.
Well, you think, my God, he's going to fall apart, and then he just whips out the guitar solo,
still
and you're like, holy smokes.
Music is actually a little bit of a special case, because a lot of people retain their musical abilities late in Alzheimer's, but it's a similar idea.
How is it properly pronounced, by the way?
Alzheimer's.
With a T?
A-L-Z-H.
Yeah, but it sounds like you're saying Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's.
Like German, like Alz.
Alzheimer's. Probably true. Probably Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's.
So the lawyer. So tell me on the campus. You been to Hazelden?
No.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
I know.
It's like like the Harvard of rehab.
I know. You know what I mean? I know that.
And so I was in Cronin always. Okay. Yep. Cronin. Schumacher's for all the people that don't really do it right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You really do view it as the Harvard.
It really
rehab
is. It's one of the greatest experiences of my life.
Hey, I can say stop right there. How many treatments after that before he gets over?
21 more.
Okay.
during that last
treatment. It was a hard case, they say.
Bob, after that
reluctant to recover.
After that last treatment, did you know that was it?
Yes, that was also with the legal profession, with Mr. Sherman Block here at the Twin Towers.
That's when he got the message.
That's when I got all the messages of Hazelden 9 years before.
Sherman Block or Sheriff?
To be there.
The Sheriff?
We were planting the seeds.
Yeah. All the seeds came to fruition
in prison.
The pill module
I'm
of
just
Twin
wondering,
Towers.
I'm sure you guys have already discussed this, but like Rehab 16, you just went, I'll be back.
No, I always went to the nice one where they treated you nice and all the rock stars were for like 8 times in a row. And you'd go there, and your friends would be there, and they'd smuggle jugs in. And
I don't think you know how bad Bob was. I don't think you understand.
I do know.
Okay. I mean,
I know from what I've seen in the documentary and stuff. But
the Chili Peppers wouldn't hang out with him.
Yeah, they didn't want me to know
they're
where
scared
they live.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
But I loved going to exits. But I always and just to defend my Hazelden experience, every rehab center I went to afterwards always said, Hazelden, that's a real rehab. That's what I'd say to every rehab I went to.
Perfect.
Though they would probably want me to go back to Hazelden. And be in their rehab.
Right.
So where is it on the campus there?
Well, we don't actually segregate the lawyers. They're all on their own units, but then bring them together for, you know, specialized groups.
And
That's
cool.
So
they're at all the different ones. Anybody in Jelnik? Anybody have to go long term?
Sometimes, yeah. But we actually just changed Jelnik. It's no longer long term.
Oh, it's not?
No. It's now a unit that is for those struggling with opioids.
Oh wow, so, that's what I would have been anyway.
Let's get into this. I also want to talk to him about that program that Mackenzie taught me about, their 12-track.
12-core.
12-core.
Core 12.
Yeah, core 12. Because we have lots of strong feelings about Suboxone and all this kind of stuff, and so we want to get into that. We'll take a quick break. Be right back.
All conversations and information exchanged during participation in the This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob Forrest podcast or interaction with drdrew.com website is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction per se. Nothing on these podcasts or posted on this site supplements or supersedes the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the sites or podcasts.
We're back. This live Bob Forrest. We have our guest today is Patrick Krill and the great Mike Carano, who's part of our pod squad. Mike,
yes, he is.
Bob, we're going to have a pod squad. Mike
a
is
pod squad.
Yes, you are. You are
it's
member
almost
one.
Embarrassing,
the future.
Sammy.
Let's just start saying it now. The future director of Comedy Cares,
which is fantastic.
Thanks.
That is such a big deal.
I don't even know what I'm going to be doing yet. How's that a big deal?
Because I've seen what happened to Music Cares. And I've seen what happened to these grassroots programs in this town. They are and
cut
this,
to
eventually
2 years
you'll be
from
corrupt
now.
And hanging out with Bob Dylan.
I'm going to jail for stealing money,
misappropriation of funds. But here,
you'll make $365,000 a year for doing nothing.
But. I said, is this one of those things where I'm going to take a huge salary?
Yeah, but Mike,
30% of the annual budget goes to you, Mike.
Here's my thing.
Bob Dole's wife and I are hanging out.
Comedy community has needed this for a long time,
so
I'm really delighted to see this.
And the problem is every time a comedian dies, we talk about it, and then we just, whatever. And we don't
a lot
do
of bipolar
it.
And personality stuff
oh,
in
yeah.
the group, too. But anyway, let's go back to Patrick. We were talking about the Hazleton program, and Bob and I have grave concerns about how we select people for Suboxone treatment and the opiate. The opiate situation is so out of control and such a mess. And so many physicians are treating this disease, don't understand it.
Right.
Everyone's getting shotgun treatment with the replacement therapies. And the one question I always ask is, if these replacement therapies are so wonderful, golly, why is it when a physician gets addiction, we never consider that? We only do abstinence treatment to nurses and physicians. Huh, isn't that funny? But our patients, we'll give them a bunch of opioids. So
here comes the question of truth. Can you be on Suboxone and practice law?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually,
because they're lawyers, they manipulated out of it. Well, doctors won't. They can't practice medicine.
You can't fly an aircraft.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that because I just got an inquiry a couple of weeks ago from a state bar examiner. They had an applicant trying to get into to be admitted to the bar who was on Suboxone, and the bar examiners were looking basically for an advisory opinion. Do you think this person can practice law? And assuming they're sort of, you know, taking the medication as
how
prescribed.
How much before you're intoxicated?
Right. Which is
8 milligrams, 16 milligrams, 32 milligrams?
I would say 8.
Okay. 4 to 8, you could say somebody could function on. But we feel like that's somebody who's still in jeopardy all the time.
If I was on trial for a third strike, I wouldn't want them to be my lawyer.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Right.
So, and it's a problem in airline pilots. It's a problem in the unions. You have machinery operators. It's been a problem about Suboxone is what is the point of intoxication?
And then who?
Let alone whether they're only taking that because, you know, drug testing is more sophisticated now. But before
not
when
that
it
good.
Started,
not that good.
When
no,
it started,
Bob,
you just tested positive for opiates.
Bob, if you were taking Suboxone and needed to get around a drug test, any
problem? Elvis's pee.
Any problem? Any problem?
That's my 5-year-old.
Wait, how can they put a number on an alcohol intoxication? They can't put a number on this drug.
It's complicated. That's why.
But alcohol will be complicated as well because it was someone's determination as to this is the amount where you're legally drunk.
It's much more predictably motor effective, affecting.
So
motor
you don't know if a person's high based on their dose.
It's hard to tell.
You
but
can
wouldn't
tell
that be the
when
same
they
thing
kind
with
of
alcohol?
Fall asleep.
If you're a giant guy, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
But your blood level the blood level correlates with certain motor impairments. Pretty reliably.
Well, a certain level of alcohol in a big guy or a little girl would result in different actions and different behavior, right?
Well, you're bringing up actually something that is a little complicated, but the blood level would be the blood level, and that blood level associated with motor dysfunction. However, one of the strongest predictors of having a strong genetic potential for alcoholism is being resistant to motor intoxication by alcohol. So it's what an interesting phenomenon.
But so let me throw it back to you. What about a lawyer who's on another prescription drug, right? So maybe their psychiatrist is prescribing.
It's very different. The drugs, opioids, benzos. I would not let them be on benzos.
But
sleeping meds,
but
I'd be very concerned about that.
You know, prescription medication use and abuse is pretty common in the legal profession. And the use, it's really hard to know. Is somebody, because if they're taking it as prescribed.
We're pretty hardcore in our sort of assessment of things. You know, our thing is that you're an addict or you're not. If you're an addict, you're taking a benzo, it's game on. You may be controlling it. You may be following directions. You're still in your disease.
Oh, absolutely, for somebody who's an addict, yeah. But I'm just talking about the impairment piece. Because there, there are a lot of attorneys out there who are on prescription medication for a variety of reasons, some of it legit, some of it not legit, but I would argue that those people may be equally as impaired as the person on Suboxone, but they're just sort of taking it to manage their anxiety as prescribed by their...
I would suggest that the difference is that people are taking... People have the disease of addiction. When they're taking chemicals that activate that disease in any way, they're... One of the associated phenomenon is lying, obfuscating, and maybe some behaviors
being
that aren't so
late,
good.
A little tardy.
Yeah, and right. so you know what I mean. But being on a high dose of Zoloft or something, not associated with that, even for an addict,
right?
And not even necessarily a moderate dose of benzodiazepine in a non-addict, but an addict who is using even a small amount of something, I expect behavioral disturbances trouble with the truth.
But let's get back to his evidence. His evidence is that a third of the population is susceptible. Is that what your survey said? Okay, so this is what scares everybody. The numbers are higher in the medical profession.
For what? For what?
For abuse and addiction.
Yeah.
Not for drinking, though. We found the rate of problem drinking in the legal profession is double that of doctors.
Really?
That makes sense.
And the other interesting thing about...
What was the assessment of the difference between abusing and addicted?
Well, we didn't. It was a survey. So
heavy
drinking.
Okay. We weren't able to actually complete assessments. These weren't structured.
They're kind of anonymous.
Heavy drinking is heavy drinking.
Here's the thing. We know traditionally or historically, medical profession, jet fighter pilots, top of the heap, entertainment, law.
Yeah.
Right? These are the people we look to in society to be leaders.
Yeah.
And influence the society and its thinking and its...
No doubt.
And when even if 20% of that population is intoxicated or impaired on a regular basis, it's a contributing factor into our lost society, I believe.
I couldn't agree more.
But don't you think it's like a catch-22 where if you're that driven and you're going to be that kind of person, you're also going to want to quell it and like it's just a bunch of chaos. Can we just do a show where we talk about how fun drugs are for once?
Let's get to it. Do you think Trump's on drugs or not?
Not.
No.
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 No way.
His face is so red. You don't think he's drinking?
I think he's eating too much.
I really don't think he drinks. I think he's so focused on himself that he doesn't take time to go home.
Everybody.
You think Hillary needs some benzos once in a while to get over the Saunders thing?
It'd be kind of funny.
Huh? For sure, right? No?
Get over what thing?
She didn't expect this Bernie Sanders phenomenon. It must piss her off so much. She's got to have a Xanax once in a while.
For sleep, at least.
I know nothing of politics. Let me just state that. And I don't want to talk about politics. But I'm not a comedian. I'm a photographer. But here's what I love about Donald Trump.
Comedy Care is your new job.
First of all, if you look at it, here's what I love about Donald Trump is I love watching the other guys whom I despise just watch their dreams go up in smoke because a psycho is on. It's like letting a monkey on the stage and they're like, okay, you're out of your career now, bye. I love that, watching these professional
how I felt when grunge came along.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I've noticed that one thing he is able to do, whatever this thing is he's doing, is that anyone that responds to him looks like they're out of their mind.
Absolutely.
The ex-president of Mexico looked like you'd need a psychiatric hospital. I'm like, this is Jason.
Rubio tried to say that his penis is probably too small.
Yeah.
This is for the president.
It's unbelievable.
But Mr.
Trump's evoking that in these guys. That's what's so awesome. Yeah.
But it's funny watching professional politicians who just, everything's a soundbite and everything's studied, watching their dreams just.
Yeah, but Rubio's young. And he's got that friend that...
But still, it's 4 years that he got shot. I like it.
Anyways, but you know, what's funny is, I've always said this, most politicians and leaders in our country come from the profession of law, right?
I do.
It's weird. Why not medicine? Why not, you know, now entertainment with Ronald Reagan and Schwarzenegger and whatever. But it is the primary occupation of our leadership in this country, and we're a lost country.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it?
But we're a nation of laws.
Philosophically, it's kind of strange.
You know, I was having a conversation a couple of weeks ago with a judge here in California about this issue after we published this study, and she read it and she saw what trouble the profession's in. And, you know, she was talking to me how she's so troubled because, and her words, all justice flows from the legal profession, right? All justice for our society.
Sure.
And if you have one between one-fifth and one-third of these individuals, and we only surveyed licensed attorneys who were currently practicing in the profession. So these weren't just people who went to law school and went off and did something else. These are people, 15,000 we surveyed.
Front lines.
Who are in the profession practicing today. You know, and she was talking to me, and it's so true. Everything, all justice, our whole society, it's underpinning our whole society. And a significant amount of these people are, you know, dealing with their own issues. You have to wonder how much they're really focused on the work they're doing, how present they are. You know,
I would just flip it around and say, hey, two-thirds are well. Those two-thirds need to step up and take care of the rest of them.
Well, they do. They really do need to step up and take care of the rest of them. And that's a big problem. You know, it's been the inverse of the see something, say something. It's like, you know, see something, don't say anything. And
unless it's to your advantage.
Unless it's to your advantage. Or, you know, when else it comes up, Bob, in a firm setting, if somebody's billable hours start to suffer, if they're not delivering the goods, if they're not, you know, bringing money into the firm, that's when, you know, the partners, the colleagues will tend to step up and say something. Meanwhile, they've known that, you know, their neighbors struggling.
Whatever we do with this bit of data is that for men particularly, the workplace is the last place to be affected by any using. Whatever they're using, if the work environment is being, or performance is being affected by their disease, they're way on. It's the last thing to be affected. So you could also argue that they may be okay. You know what I mean? It's late in the course of alcoholism that their work is measurably affected.
Oh, so maybe they're drinking at a really high level, but it's not.
Not yet. It'll happen, but maybe maybe a set of criteria need to be set up to go, you know, you must step in at this point or something.
Well, at a minimum, they're at risk, right? At a minimum, the people we identify.
Well, I would argue they probably are not doing what they should. Again, what troubles me is the lying and obfuscating what goes on with this disease. If you're involved with justice, how the hell?
Right.
How do you do that?
Well, I do know, just let's think about the practical. I only deal in criminal justice, right? So there's defense attorneys in the public defender's office who know what DAs have drinking problems. And there's a quid pro quo there that's not talked about. It's not overtly talked about. It's like, come on here, do me a favor here. Give him
horse trading, you're talking about.
Yeah. And it's based on...
Did you just say come on, Ed?
Huh?
Horse trading.
Did you just say someone's name?
Huh?
No, come on, Ed. Come on here.
Come on, let this kid go to alternative sentencing, for instance. DA's got 30 cases she or he is overwhelmed with. She's hung over. I've been there in court where you can see that the DA's hung over. You know what I mean? Sweaty, not a little unkempt. And you see the public defender's office just say, come on, do me a favor here. And that's the justice that we've got here in this city. I don't know about up where you've practiced.
Well, I did used to practice here in L.A., but...
Hill Street?
No.
Oh, my God. No, that's where I work.
I was in civil law, but what I can tell you is that we found that the problems are widespread. You know, we had 15,000 lawyers from 19 states, and it was consistent. It was everywhere. It wasn't just L.A. It wasn't just New York City. It wasn't just Kentucky. We have, you know, consistent problems throughout the profession, which I think suggests it's something about the culture of the legal profession that people were brought into starting in law school. Another interesting thing we found, though, we asked what percentage of you think you've ever had a problem with alcohol. About 25% acknowledge they think it's been a problem. And of that portion, roughly a third said it started before law school. So you have a lot of people coming into law school who are already sort of predisposed or having problems with alcohol. So I don't know if we're, you know, not screening for that well enough or what it is about the profession that's attracting.
But the good news is just alcohol. So my profession gets the opiates and everything else going too, which is far more nefarious.
Is that so?
It's historical.
We have access.
It's historical because if you get a possession charge up until like the last 10 years, you're California. And so in law school, I remember a friend of mine's lawyer in New York, and he was in second year of law school, and we used to do coke and go out and see bands all the time. He came by my house and he goes, you know what, I'm gonna have to cut the coke out. But he was drinking like a all night, And he always bought the Coke. So I was kind of bummed. Like,
why are we cutting
and
it out?
I was like, why are you stopping? He goes, because I really got to get prepared for two. You know, I'm going to be a lawyer. And if I get a possession charge, that's the end of me.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the mentality that was ingrained in people in law school and along the pipeline, that you can't do drugs. You can get face drunk
right
in law school. And yeah. That's the great, I won't say his name, but if he listens to the podcast, he'll know who it is.
Well, what do you want people to know? Where do you want this to go? Is there anything you want sort of listeners to do, or attorneys who might be listening to do?
Well, what I want attorneys who might be listening to do is to know that, you know, you can get help, and it's not necessarily going to impact your career. It's not going to impact your license if you get ahead of the problem. You know,
is there a place people can reach you?
There's a lot of misinformation. Me particularly?
Well, if they
yeah,
want to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
I would. They're free to email me at pkrill, P-K-R-I-L-L, at hazeldenbettyford.org. That's my email.
H-A-Z-E-L-D-E-N. It's Hazelden.
Bettyford.org. Yep. Right. Yep. One word. Thank you for that. But the main point of this study was to really just sort of expose the problem, because I think this is telling too. The medical profession has probably had a dozen studies done on the rates of impairment, the rates of drug use, alcohol use.
There's so many systems in
okay, so way yeah. many more than yeah. that. So this was the first. It was the first ever national study of these issues.
That's crazy. There's got to be other ones. Maybe it's for some by lawyers.
There was one. No, there was only one other study. It was from 1990.
What?
And right. That's why I actually went to the American Bar Association a couple of years ago, and I said, "This is really problematic. We need to study."
You know what this is? This is why I ended up studying the narcissism in celebrities, because I had access. Same thing. If you're coming from within the profession, you have access.
Right. But so this was the first study since 1990, and it was the first ever national study, which really points to the problem. The legal profession has not wanted to look at these issues.
What's the trend from the 90s study to now?
The rate of problem drinking has increased slightly. So it was a big problem then, based on that study.
And probably a lot of, and let's assume that in 1990, I bet you a lot of people lied on the survey.
Probably.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Sure.
It's so
well, especially because it was probably a phone survey, right?
I don't know how they administered it in 1990, actually.
Now it was via email?
Ours was electronic, yeah.
You said you want people to know their careers are not necessarily going to be impacted. That would freak me out.
Okay, yeah. So.
No, but I want to hear, no, this that is anonymous.
That sounds like a lawyer's talking.
No one's going to know about your thing. I don't want to hear, we're not saying, it's my, I don't know.
Thanks, Mike, for actually clarifying. Because what I meant by that is if you get help before you've actually done something.
Okay, got it, yeah.
Because
so far, you've gotten away with it. Say it in junkie terms. So far, you've gotten away with it. But if you're something's going to happen here, and we can help you.
Get help before you commit malpractice, before you end up in front of the disciplinary board, and it won't impact your license. There's no penalty for getting treatment. And there's a lot of misinformation out there in the legal profession, and you know, there's just this fear that if anybody finds out, including the lawyer assistance program, you know, that it's going to somehow impact my license. And so they don't seek help, and then they end up getting jammed up with discipline or committing malpractice, getting sued, whatever. And the underlying cause of it, which was their addiction, becomes exposed. And then, you're sort of facing two things. Yeah. So you're not going to face any sort of blowback professionally if you get ahead of it, and that's really my main message.
You know, there's a lot of sober lawyers here, very very proactive, very outspoken, not anonymous in Los Angeles. Barry, for one thing,
but
he was very outspoken and says he's sober all the time.
You know, it's Darren Cavanaugh too,
and Myra too, the judge, right? He's retired now.
Yeah,
they were very outspoken. And I felt
they were
like, why are they so
too,
outspoken? Listen. More outspoken than musicians that are sober. And they like going on Larry King. So what was that about? The handfuls of sober lawyers and judges in the communities were so adamant and so outspoken and so breaking their anonymity. Why have you seen a trend in that?
No, but we need more of that.
That must be here. We should get Darren in here. Darren Cavanaugh, he's the 1-800 no cuffs guy, but he's very involved in his recovery. He was a bad drug addict too.
Okay, that to me, is there a level of hypocrisy there? Because he,
let's ask him.
All his,
I know,
ads are, you've been drinking and driving, call me 1-800 no cuffs.
Yeah, but maybe
but it
has,
is.
But maybe he has a follow on with that where he gets people on into recovery. You know, if you can get people out of prison into recovery, good. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. You want to interview him.
Well, that sounds just, you know, I'm the sober guy, but hey, I have a bar in the corner. Just want to drink. I'm not saying.
Everyone's entitled to a defense, Mike.
I'm curious about the mental state of people that have addiction. I've noticed like a correlation between narcissism, feeling sorry for yourself, a lot of these traits that I see in meetings and stuff. And I wonder if being a lawyer, this might be just a legal thing. I always wonder what people's mindset is. And me, as a regular citizen, and a lot of people think we're protected by the law. Oh, we're kind of safe. We're protected. But as a lawyer, you understand how it actually works, and you understand the mathematics of it, and behind this, and that it can be manipulated, and what's involved in squirming your way through things. And I don't mean in a nefarious way or in a bad way. I just mean you understand the workings of it. We think it's just, here's justice, and for me, it's going to be fair. Maybe
now and then something.
But I wonder if that affects your mental condition as an addict, where there's a lot of guilt. Well, or there's a, because you realize this is just.
Everything's relative.
Everything is relative. Yeah. You know, there is, we're all a bunch of animals, and I happen to have a better dart gun than other people do.
So there's a lot of disillusionment in the legal profession among practicing lawyers for reasons like that, right? Because you kind of see what this is all about, what this justice system is all about, and the level of career satisfaction is oftentimes quite low. The disillusionment, the, you know, sort of demoralizing atmosphere. And, you know, that tends to drive people to a lot of self-medication. And, yeah.
So well, the other occupation I would say that I've dealt with that really has that is homicide detectives. It's unbelievable.
Because
can you imagine?
Trauma?
It's what they see people do.
That's
too.
What I mean.
It's what they see every day. We had this guy that was 25 years.
I watched
homicide
four episodes of Forensic
LAPD.
Files today. Oh, yeah. I almost got out of my mind.
He had become so cynical about mankind. You couldn't even get him to look at something to motivate him to want to be sober. Mm-hmm. It was crazy. You
well,
know
how
saying?
How about a grief counselor?
Well, funny.
What the hell is that job?
I'm licensed to be a grief therapist. Is there something wrong? I have a good sense of humor.
Here's what happened, and I have this is not a joke. I saw a grief counselor recently.
Well, let's switch gears. We're going to switch gears, Patrick, because this is actually what I want to talk.
Well,
about.
I just
this is a tragic thing. We got to fill him in. His sister, we just said, driving down the street a couple months ago, tree falls and hits her and kills her.
In the car.
I still think about it today. I
think about it every day.
Oh, my fucking God. And we all know that's a possibility in life, but rarely does it ever happen to you or your family member.
Yeah.
And so he's been dealing with that, and we've been letting him not talk about it, but today I decided to push a little
but
more.
But with the grief counseling thing, I don't see where there's any job satisfaction in. She's never going home when her husband's like, how was your day? And she's like, horrible. I mean, that's, you know, that is what's happening every day. That's happening. She's never leaving going, I love my job. No one ever goes, I feel better. Thanks.
I heard a woman talk about, she was the one, she worked for the police force, and she was the one that had to do the
announcing.
What do they call it when they
like a press conference or
family?
Can you imagine? That's your daily. Got four of them today.
That's the worst.
She did hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of
that's
them.
The.
And she said exactly the same thing happened every time. Now she was in it because she'd been through it. So much like, you know, how do people become chemical dependency counselors and deal with addicts all day? Sometimes when you've been through it, it's part of your own healing. It's part of your giving back, your deeper appreciation of what people are going through. But this woman talked about how she would knock on the door. She would do the, what's it called? Like the announcement, whatever it is. There's a name for
notification.
It. Notification. Do the notification. And she said in all cases, people go to the floor. They go to the ground. Hmm. And she goes down with them, and she stays there until they come up. And she said they always come up. People always come off the floor. And that's her sort of metaphor for getting through and working through and the empowerment of the resiliency of the human soul and mind. She finds great, I don't want to use the word like satisfaction, but reassurance, I guess, in taking people through that. Does that make sense?
It's self-convoluted. It's it's generated inside of you then if you're getting satisfaction. If you're not getting it from the outside, nobody's going to thank you for help.
Well, they are eventually saying thank you maybe. For being here.
Okay, maybe. Know. But I just don't see, like, if somebody were on stage and they're getting a payoff from the audience applauding them, that there's
fun.
An immediate payoff.
That seems
I thought you weren't involved in comedy.
You know what?
But
what
by the way, he will be at the comedy club, the improv comedy.
Oh, yeah, I'm doing a show on the 26th.
Oh, my God.
I don't know if it's going to be comedy. Though. I don't know what I'm going to do.
And by the way, he means it. I've been
it's
through.
An hour
I, he
of
and
death.
I did one of these. We just got up there and did it.
What do you think? Why biologically do they drop? Do you think?
I think they've seen it on television.
Or duck.
I think you lose your parasympathetic.
Do you really? Wait, I'm sorry. Do you really think
that's
a possibility?
People become weak in the knees. Right?
Yeah, weak in the knees.
What did I see on TV? I'm supposed to do this.
Swooning. No, your parasympathetic nervous system kicks in, your heart rate goes down to 20, and you have to sit down.
You definitely have to sit down.
But they go down.
I just thought there might be some weird evolutionary.
How'd you find out?
It is.
How'd you find out?
I was standing in a coffee shop, and I walked outside.
Somebody call?
Yeah. It was bad. Super bad. It was bad. It was terrible.
It was better than finding out on Twitter.
Yeah.
That's how I found out.
I meant to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Was that your mom's sister?
Which one?
What?
When you said you lost...
Oh, my mom.
3 years ago?
3 years ago?
Yeah.
Who did I lose three
no, he
years
found out my about your sister.
Oh, yeah. No, that was my younger sister.
But that wasn't
my mom.
Okay.
Was it your actual
just
sister?
There. You're just sitting there like, what the is he talking about?
Well, when you told me that...
sister was my mother, and I didn't know it. Yeah. You know, ever heard of those stories like Jack Nicholson and all that?
Wow.
50s and 60s.
Okay.
So then my sister, we're talking about my sister who died a couple weeks ago, and that was my younger sister.
Okay.
Not my mom.
Well, I was when I left.
Actually, your
I
sister
like,
or your...
My aunt.
Oh, for Christ's sake. See?
Uncle Dad was coming over to tell me that...
She was my
Uncle
sister.
Captain
my
and I, sister wife.
I loved her like a sister.
My doctor grandpa was coming by and...
So that's that same thing. Why? Who was that person? Just a
my
friend?
Brother called me from Your the brother? Scene. Yeah,
somebody told him or somebody.
No, he
told
was there.
He was there.
Well, she was driving to a gig. Somebody called my brother and said Nikki didn't show up for the gig, and he knows she's never missed a gig out of the 3,000 gigs she's done in 25 years or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And he started driving the route. Called my dad, and my dad heard all the fire trucks, and my dad left, and they both got there at the same time.
Oh my God!
Yeah, it was brutal. So, I'm not trying to be nonchalant about it, but it's kind of like I'm all. It's just.
I don't think you know. Let's talk about grief therapy for a second. I know we're getting a little off the subject, but I've always felt when the time is right. Like I didn't grieve the deaths of my parents, especially my dad, who I love so much, till I was like. Till like 5 years later.
Oh, I hate
remember,
that feeling. Then.
And I, 6 years later, and I'll tell you what it was. Because I just idolized him and I loved him so much. And he died when I was 15. I was listening to John Cougar Mellencamp, the song, Boy, They Told You Gonna Be President, but just like everything else, those old crazy dreams just kind of came and went. Ain't That America, mm-hmm. right? You know that song? Yeah. My dad used to always tell me that I could be president of the United States. And I get choked up now about it.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't go away, Mike.
I don't like the feeling that that this could be still hanging on here 5 years.
But you got to embrace it. It's beautiful. It's the tapestry of life. That what happened to her is just so crazy. I think that is what I think about more than just loss.
But let me assuage, answer you and make you feel a little better. 15-year-olds can't grieve. For the most part.
They get grief therapy, I guarantee you
I understand.
You
to try to get
from
them
a Catholic
grief.
Priest,
Wait, what would you call that? Yeah, exactly. This isn't helping.
They can't really.
I'm not a genius, but I think this is making it worse.
Oh, my God, he's not a comedian. It wasn't that kind. I sat with the father in the church.
Son, I've got something that will take your mind off your dead dad.
Did you see that in Spotlight? That's one of the.
I didn't see Spotlight.
That was one of the stories.
No, what?
Yes. That the priest made the kid whose dad had just died.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That could have been me.
Do you want to hear? Can I? I don't know.
He worked in Hazelden. We should go light on the Catholic stuff.
I don't know if I want to mention what I did this morning because I think
did it involve you?
She might be upset that I
Tara?
Brought this up. No, Anna David.
Oh yeah, she's good. She's been on the show before.
I like how you just spoke for her. I haven't even said what I'm going to say.
But I mean, Anna's...
All right, I drove her to get an abortion.
We're good. No, I don't think she liked that. No, but I mean,
Having a difficult time.
We'll call Anna and see if she's going.
Her cat of 18 years was very sick and had to be put down. And I said, do you want me to go with you? That was a week ago. And she said, that would be great.
Yeah.
Would you do it? And I went, yeah. And then immediately thought, well, will I do this? But it didn't happen. And then today, I saw her this morning and she goes, I'm going to go do the cat. It would, you know, really help me out if you were there. And I went, I'm all over it. So, of course, I was late. And I'm trying to make her comfortable. And this is going to sound like I'm just tooting my own horn because I was so funny. But I feel sick now. Okay. I show up. Mm. This is about death, by the way. I built this up way too much. I go in there. She's with her cat.
Mm.
She's not doing well.
Yeah.
Very upset. Mm. And we talk for a few minutes. And then she goes, can you get the doctor? Because I want to get this over with. And I went, yeah. And I walked out and I said, she's ready to do it. And they went, we'll be in a minute. And I walked in and she said, what'd they say? And I said, they told me to do it. And I walked over and picked up some gloves and stuff. And she didn't think it was a joke.
Oh, my
God. I had to go, And then the nurse came in and the nurse said, I've got a pinched nerve. I'm sorry. It took me a minute to get in here. And I went, do you mind if I touch you? And she said, I don't know. And I said, I'm just going to push on your shoulder and see if it makes it feel better. So now I'm like 30 seconds into this back rub. And Anna goes,
what's happening?
Can we focus on the cat? And then she said, how are they going to do it? And I said, they're going to take a little pillow and put it over his face like a mafia hit. And then they asked me to leave. And I didn't leave like, aha, that was so funny. I left like, oh, I feel sick. Like I did the opposite of what I was supposed to do. And I sent her a text to apologize again like the fourth time. And she goes, this is harder than I thought. And she hadn't responded the second time.
Can we help?
We'll deal with it.
I was just trying to be funny, and it was so not funny to everyone else.
But you can't beat yourself up about it. Here's the thing. I had to go tell my friend that his brother
Hold a second. It was funny. It's just, I can understand why it wasn't received as funny. You know what I'm saying?
You got to know your audience.
Yeah. It's not funny. It is funny. But not for that moment. Not for that moment.
But isn't humor laughing for some reason around?
I think there might be some
weird
time that needs to.
Yes, of
like
course.
Maybe after the cat's been gone for a week or two
to talk to her.
No, I'm going to talk to her.
Yeah, yeah.
But those are more like improv jokes. Like you have to have it in the moment, like that.
Yeah.
So
do you think listeners don't hear it when you move the microphone 6 inches away and say
something?
Let's
switch gears away from death and get back to Hazelden. Yeah.
No,
in a second.
Wait, are we? Mike, you okay? You done? Are you?
I'm okay.
There's nothing he can do about it.
Yeah.
He's sober?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So that's
good. However, I might not be. This is f***ing me up, and you might be able to help with this.
I'm always a good...
Are you familiar with kombucha?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so my friend drinks a lot of it, and I was like, I'll give that a try, and I guzzled one of them, and I went, I swear to God, I'm buzzed.
Yeah, it's caffeine.
It's got a little caffeine and a little alcohol, but it tastes horrible. Why would you drink it?
She said it's got probiotics that's good for
you. Oh, my God.
It's supposed to be good for you.
Everything's good for you. Everything that tastes horrible is good for you.
Nonchalantly, it's got a little alcohol. It's got a little this.
Well, no.
If you drank a six-pack, you'd probably get a buzz.
Yeah. You know, the thing, I'll show you addict behavior. You know the stuff that people take a tablespoon of? What's it called?
NyQuil or something?
No, like a healthy thing, like a hippie thing. You would know it.
Like a Geritol? Protein thing or something?
No. It's like a hippie Erewhon store thing.
All right, whatever.
Some that they sort of drink, right?
Okay.
So it's got a teeny bit of alcohol that's not burned off. My friend's doing it, and people start with him saying, oh, you're getting drunk and all whatever. And he started guzzling it and drinking it. And then he was drinking like 4 bottles of it a day and getting drunk.
Yeah.
And that was a relapse. A kombucha was not.
I've got a problem, you guys. I'm up to 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C.
But you know what? But you got to hear this. You're going to love this. I want to know, you're at Hazelden all the time, right?
Yeah.
Is the junkie nun still there?
The junkie nun.
She worked in the administration.
No.
She was the greatest storyteller. She was a nun. And she was an addict.
I think she was a Betty Ford.
Oh, was she a Betty Ford?
Yeah.
Wait, let's also, we got to finish the opiate story. We didn't finish the Suboxone story with Patrick, did we?
Well,
the 12.
I mean, I don't want to corner them because I know Hazelden's really, you know, they're really open-minded about Suboxone, and that's when I got disillusioned. No, they came to market to us at Los Angeles. We were out of town. Me and Barry met with them, and they had started using Suboxone as a detox med. And I just said, you open that door, and no telling where it leads to. And I didn't see why after 60 or 70 years of doing the greatest job of detoxing and stabilizing alcoholics and opiate addicts, they needed to embrace this drug. And I'm not criticizing because I love Hazelden, but and I'm sure it's a problem. You may not see it as a problem, but when you use it as a detox med, there's no way to stop what comes next, maintenance, or the continued use and abuse and in and out with it.
And then it's and all the patients preoccupying
useless
about it.
Drug. We already have methadone. Put people on methadone. Let doctors prescribe methadone to addicts. You know what I'm saying? I don't know why the laws are the way they are. You're a lawyer. Tell me. Methadone has to be distributed to addicts by the federal government, yeah. But it can be distributed by doctors to pain patients. We need to change that law and let addiction doctors prescribe methadone to patients just like they do Suboxone. This was just, to me, a way to make billions of dollars off a drug that already exists, methadone. Come on.
Can I ask a naive question because I'm not familiar with this? Suboxone is a heroin
replacement.
Opiate replacement, not just heroin.
But it's a great detox drug. What,
so you guys are seeing a big problem with Suboxone? Like people think they're getting sober and they're really just continuing
people,
along?
Only old people use it properly. Yes. Young people use it to patch in between. They die with it in their system. They think it makes them, you know, powerful and
let some work and stuff.
So the heroin addict, where does a heroin addict end up? Worse, they end up dead, right?
Yeah.
Or off heroin.
No, I think there's worse places than dead to end up, like 9 years of rehab. Yeah.
Okay, but let's, you're a heroin addict. The place you end up, is that worse than the Suboxone place you end up?
The Suboxone does have a role. And it does help some patients. The problem is that
older, more mature patients.
Well, the problem is the selection process.
Well, and I think that's key. I think the patient profile has to fit the profile of somebody who will be.
In the community, it's just being used on everybody.
I'll tell you something. Right. An indefinable consequence of its use as detox med. These f***ing kids don't know what it's like to kick heroin. Because they never have. Because doctors make the detox so easy and painless and come to us. You know what I'm saying? Yep. They need to know what they're signing up for because they're going to get it when they try to get off of Suboxone, right?
The rationale for going to Suboxone for generating the or creating this Core 12 program was to stop the amount of deaths we were seeing. Really,
yeah.
You know, we were seeing so many overdoses from
of young
patients,
people, right?
young people who couldn't stay sober and they're just returning to heroin use. And as you know, after a period of abstinence, you go back to the same dose and you overdose.
Yeah, see, that was I shot dope fucking 25 years. Every real drug addict knows when you get out of rehab and your system is clean, you don't shoot the same amount of dope you shot three weeks ago. And that, he gets mad at me, but that was just a known thing if you were a real drug addict.
No,
what we have now is pseudo drug addicts who use heroin, who don't know the deadly destructive nature of it, and they don't have any fear of it, and they have very little experience with it.
So you shooting with the HIV guy
was a skilled move? Let me finish because I'm on my soapbox.
All right. Go ahead.
So because, this is a crucial part of it, because they're forced into treatment for all the wrong reasons. They're forced in at 17 and 19 and 21 when there is no intention they have of wanting a sober lifestyle or changing their life, and nothing in their life consciousness relates to the 12-step approach or anything. Now, there are outliers and anomalies, and so everybody points to the 17-year-old boy that got sober, not the 3,000 that you've treated that wanted nothing to do with it. So we're forcing kids into treatment, which forces them to stop and start, right? And now we're going to see Suboxone as a solution to that.
But I guess what I would ask with these kids, what's the alternative? Because if they're out there using and dying, is forcing them into treatment?
They're more likely to die if they go to treatment than if they continue using. That's what I tell parents these days. They are more likely to die if they go to treatment.
Is the downside of Suboxone worse?
And return back to using, have no interest in going to treatment.
The other thing is the pills are what they're mostly dying of, too. They get the doctor, they get the opiate benzo combo, and that's it, over.
Well, the heroin's pretty strong, Drew. A lot of them are dying of heroin.
Well, that's a relatively new thing.
You know, I know that everybody, I've been around it so long, I get frustrated when we've created a problem that didn't exist before, and then we have the solution that has been around with us for 80, 90 years, which is replacement therapy. Heroin was the replacement for morphine, was it not?
Heroin was replaced for cocaine.
No, but heroin, they said, oh, it's a...
Oh, the golden years.
It's a better... every opiate that's come on the market...
We in my profession have found a replacement. Benzo is a replacement for alcohol.
Okay.
Pot is a replacement for heroin. Heroin's a replacement for cocaine. We've been doing this behavior...
This girlfriend's a replacement for that girlfriend.
Yeah, we've been doing this behavior of trying to find a replacement therapy for a spiritual malady forever. And that's what the thing about is my peers aren't trained to understand this condition. Right. And so they just think, oh, we'll find a medical in quote solution, which is a pharmaceutical.
But anyway, it is a spiritual.
We got to wrap it up.
It's a spiritual problem, and the problem is within our 18 to 34 year old age bracket. That's where all the death is, right?
Yeah,
it's really, terrible. It's that young.
18 to 34.
It's bad. Now. It's bad.
It's all overdoses.
And it all starts with pills. I'm telling you, it's where it all starts.
Pills, but if somebody mixes pills and alcohol, and then their heart stops, or whatever
pills
happens,
and pills and heroin.
Heroin and opiate and benzos.
I didn't know it was that young. I thought
it's
it was
routine.
Just,
so anyway, that's just my two cents. I don't think it's a solution. I think there's a more holistic solution, which is educating parents.
More comprehensive, more sophisticated.
And we need to heal as a people.
And proper selection of the people that need the replacement therapies.
That's really important.
We as a people need to heal. Or I don't want to live here anymore.
Bob, you shut up. You're depressing me.
No, I don't hate Donald Trump, and I don't hate Bernie Sanders. I'm a person who's an adult who can look at people's ideas, and I know why they're doing what they're doing. But this society can't anymore because of our education system.
If you get so negative, I'm not going to be able to tolerate it.
I'm not being negative. I really believe in the young people.
Let's fight for it.
I believe who's stewarding the young people are misinformed and out of touch with them and don't understand.
Yeah.
And that's the real problem.
Well, I agree with his point that we do need to heal as a society, as a culture. I mean, there's a lot of sickness out there. It's pervasive.
Yeah.
And we do. We need a broader solution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's families. It's some sort of spirituality. I think it's all stuff we always talk about. It's about caring for
good
another.
Good news is empathy. Trump's got it under control.
We're going to be winning shortly. But we are playing a song here at the end. It's Mike's song. Mike,
your song?
What song are you playing?
I Killed Your Cat song.
Which one does he want to play? I didn't kill it.
Which one would you like to play?
What'd you play last time?
So let me get this straight. You're not a comedian, you're not a musician, you're not this. You just get on stage and take photographs of the audience as a performance.
And I sell
piece?
Them, and it's a cha-ching.
No.
I don't know what I'm going to do. Last time I sang some songs and told some stories and showed some videos, and this time I'm going to probably do the same, but I might just. I don't know.
Was the
Can
last
I come
one?
And heckle you?
Wait, was Absolutely. The last one at okay. Scotty's place in Death Valley?
No, that was at the Opera
the
House.
The Opera House.
No, I did. I've done three since at
good.
The Improv.
All right, good, excellent. We'll
it's,
go.
It's a weird. Last time I apologized for 5 minutes up front, and then about how it's going to suck, and I'm sorry you paid for this, and I tried to get people to get a refund before the show started.
I want to go just.
And
to
it was
see
very
that.
Sincere. I was like, I asked a party of eight, do you know me? And they said no, and I went. You should get a refund.
I can't wait.
Because you're not going to like this.
This will be the best
and like,
part
why
of the
not? And I went, because I don't even know what it is, and I'm not a professional, and I'm probably going to fall apart, and I don't know what's going
to
happen,
all
and
right.
I wouldn't do it.
I'm going to take you out
to Did
dinner
they take
right
you up on that offer? No.
No, they stayed.
They stayed.
Patrick Krill, thank you so much.
Yeah,
I hope this was of use to you, and I hope we get the word out of it. I think we have. I think it's a topic we would not have discussed with this kind of... rigor had you not been here.
Yeah, so well, thanks for the opportunity.
Appreciate it very much.
Love
Bob.
What you're doing.
Yeah, thank we you. Do too. Mike?
Thank you for having me.
Anytime. See you next time.
Roxy and Frank, they're gonna cut you down. Poison heartbreaker, only 16, soft as a tank. And Chloe's brain's on the floor, knife blade. Is waiting for your mom. It's waiting for your mom. Be nice to me. Be nice to me. Daybreak at the Wigwam Motel. Frank. her television. A different story to tell. Heartbreak. The band is breaking up. The band is breaking up. Be nice to me. Be nice to me. Be nice to me. Be nice to me. Takes a walk down Hollywood and makes it through the backstage door. Pandemonium, and Roxy's back for good. Frank stops. You are beautiful. You are beautiful. Be nice to me.